Okay, we're going to be discussing evidences that support the idea of a young earth. I would identify myself as a young earth creationist. I think that there is no other legitimate explanation that can be given that is in keeping with the Genesis account of creation. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, because obviously there is a contrast between the view that the earth is 10,000 years old or less, and the prevalent view that the earth is 4.54 billion years old, which is that's one figure that I came across in my research on this particular matter. Now, as we have been discussing somewhat, these kinds of lessons, while very beneficial and helpful, are not particularly Bible-centered. And so I'm somewhat limited in my expertise with regard to these things. Simply done as much research and examined the argumentation as best I can. Some of the things that we're going to be talking about are things that I know very little about, but have been argued by others who believe in a young earth and believe in the creation account as being the inspired word of God and literal, and who have backgrounds in science. And the problem with this kind of thing is if you take an argument like this, you will have those who are evolutionists that will say this is not right and this is why, which would seem to debunk the argument until such time as you have an individual with a scientific background who believes in the young earth creation. Said, no, that's not right. This is what it is. And those things have been argued and bandied about for quite a while. Again, as to the definitive nature of any of these particular arguments, I cannot state with any surety because of my lack of expertise in that matter, but I defer to the expertise of others who have argued for it. And I think that there is some legitimacy in these things, and that's why we're going to be talking about this. I do want to begin, however, by going to the fifth chapter of the book of Genesis to start off for just a few moments, if you would turn there. Okay, we've got a full class. I like that. Full class this evening. And again, we're going to be talking about the concept of a young earth. And want to just start by looking at the introductory paragraphs on the page, and then we'll go over to Genesis 5. It says that one obvious contrast between the theory of evolution and the biblical account of creation is the age of the universe, the age of the earth, and the life that is upon it. I came across these various figures, which are representative, though by no means our evolution is completely in agreement upon these numbers, but evolutionists say, in general, the universe is about 14 billion years old, 13.82. That's really pretty specific, but that's if you do a Google search, age of the universe, first thing that comes up is 13.82 billion years old. The Earth, evolutionists believe, was formed about 4.54 billion years ago. First life appeared about 3.49 billion years ago in the form of bacteria or virus, not viruses, but bacteria, very simple bacteria. And then man first walked the earth about 200,000 years ago. Now, that is, of course, seeking to distinguish what is referred to as Homo sapiens and earlier forms of hominids. And the belief is that maybe, if not immediate ancestors, near ancestors of man, through the evolutionary process, have existed up to 4 million years ago. So that's the view that is held. Now, none of these dates, again, are universally accepted. There are disagreements as to the validity of any particular figure. But regardless of that, the concept of extreme age with regard to the universe is something that flies in the face of the Genesis account of creation. Now, what we have in the Genesis account of creation, back in Genesis chapter 1, is the statement, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. The Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters." Then God said, let there be light. There was light. God saw the light, that it was good. God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day. The darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day.
What you're saying is, if this was a court of law, that's the only first-person account we have. The rest is a hearsay.
That's a good point, yeah. First-person account, that's right. And that's a point that we're going to make a number of times, because the assumptions that evolutionists make with regard to the age of the earth, the way in which they go about determining the age of the earth, is based upon what we'll refer to as the doctrine of uniformitarianism, which is a doctrine, it is a belief that they hold to that is based upon various assumptions that are unprovable because they weren't there. And again, you know, that's one of the things. I don't know if any of you remember this debate between Bill Nye, the science guy, and Ken Ham, who was the president or head of the Institute for Creation Research. But they, I think that's right, as far as the Ken Ham. But they had an argument, a debate on the particular subject of these things, and I completely forgot what I was going to say about that. I had it, and then I got sidetracked about where Ken Ham was in that regard, and forgot. Oh yeah, historical versus observable science. And Bill Nye didn't like that distinction made. He said, that's the first I've heard about that. But it's kind of an obvious thing. You may have coined it, but it's an obvious thing, is that observable science is science that can be replicated via experimentation. It is what typically scientists do. They will make an experiment. They will see the results of that experiment. They will change their hypotheses and develop theorems and establish laws based upon observable things. And then there is what he referred to, Ken Ham referred to as historical science, which is something that we only have data which may be interpreted because we weren't present, we could not observe the actual process. No individual has ever observed the process of macroevolution. When we talk about macroevolution with regard to the evolution of life, it has reference to kinds mutating or changing, evolving into other kinds. You'll remember that in the Genesis account, we're told that the animals and the plants, all of them during procreation, they procreated they multiplied according to their own kind. And so there are some strict guidelines. Now, we talk about speciation in our day and time, and they say, well, you know, there are examples of one species and another species that they are able to mate and create something new or something different. But species and kinds are not the same thing. There's a biblical concept of kinds. And that's something that cannot be, never has been, cannot be observed, because even the evolutionists who claim the theory is so will state that it takes too much time for the processes to be completed to have a mutation from one kind to another. And so it can only be interpreted as so because it cannot be directly observed. And so there is a difference between what we might refer to as that practical science that is practiced each day and that which is historical in its nature. And that, of necessity, takes assumption, it takes interpretation of data. And the interesting thing about it is that if you take the time to do research with regard to the creationists and young earth creationists and data that they have supplied and interpretations that they have placed upon it, then there's quite a bit of evidence there as well. And we've actually talked, we're going to talk a little bit about some of those things in our lesson this evening. And so it's how you interpret the data that necessitates, by its nature, faith. This is what I believe to have happened. And so depending upon how you interpret the data, the assumptions that you make, and we'll just kind of throw this out as we begin, there is a different view that we hold concerning the existence of things as they are and what the evolutionist holds. His is the doctrine of uniformitarianism. We've got a definition of that in the material that we'll get to in a few moments. And by our acceptance of Bible teaching, we take a catastrophic view of history. And we'll, and if you look at the evidences that are supplied, many of them will give the interpretation that these things are the result of the worldwide flood that is recorded in Genesis. And so there are two different ways of looking at the data. One as a uniformitarian approach. The other is a catastrophic approach to the data. And the interesting thing is that depending upon which view you take, you get very different time frames. You get very different ideas coming from the same data. It's a matter of interpretation rather than something that is sure and certain with regard to the data itself. So there's data, and then there are those who interpret data. You know, facts don't lie, but those who interpret the facts sometimes do. I know that's kind of a paraphrase of another phrase that's commonly used, but it's something we need to keep in mind. Just because you have the scientists who say this does not necessarily mean that it's so. Okay, so with that in mind, the point that I made in Genesis 1 and 1 through 5 is that there is a beginning of the universe, and between verse 1 and verse 2, there are some who suppose that there is an indeterminate length of time. They try to get the billions of years in between those. Really, there's no reason to do that. Number one, it's not there contextually. There's no indication of that gap theory between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. If you look at the first five verses, they read as a paragraph, as a thought. This is what happened, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. We don't know how much time passed between verse 1 and verse 2, I suppose. But it doesn't in any way set aside the problems with the concept of an old universe, because we have not until day 5 the creation of sun, moon, and the stars, the lesser lights of the sky. So for someone to say it was created and then say, but it wasn't until day 5 that they became, quote, visible, well, that just does violence to the Genesis text. If I can get anything before you and have you remember this and understand this, is that you cannot in any way make Genesis 1 and evolutionary theory reconcile. It's not possible. And anyone who thinks that that is the case, what they are doing is they are taking the Genesis account and they are distorting it in some way in order to make it reconcile with the views, the scientific views, or the evolutionary views of science in our day and time. You cannot take the reading at face value and get evolution from it. And so if we're going to accept that the Holy Spirit inspired Genesis 1, and we're accepting that it's a historical account, we've already discussed that with regard to the issue of the day-age theory that we talked about in previous classes, then we have to recognize that you can't reconcile Genesis 1 with the evolutionary theory. So from that, we see that there was 6 days of creation. He rested on the seventh day. On the sixth day, Adam and Eve were created. Now, if you go from there to Genesis chapter 5, you find a genealogy that exists. Now, there are individuals who demand that there be gaps in the genealogy. There are some who say, no, you have to take the genealogy as it is. It's found in Genesis chapter 5 from Adam to Noah. You'll notice the book of genealogy of Adam, and the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. And so we're told in verse 3 that Adam lived 130 years, begot a son in his likeness after his image, named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years. So we accept at face value that Adam lived for 930 years. You go down through the genealogy, you get down to verse 31. All the days of Lamech were 770 years, and he died. And Noah was 500 years old when he begat Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So we have a series of generations that are found in Genesis chapter 5 until such time as Noah and the flood. Now you pick back up in Genesis chapter 10. In Genesis chapter 10, and there is again the statement concerning the nations descended from Noah, a description of these nations. In chapter 11, the Tower of Babel. And then you'll notice in verse 10 of chapter 11, we have the genealogy of Shem. So we pick up with regard to the actual years from one of Noah's sons, that of Shem, and we go down, and that gets us all the way to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. So this is where you get the chronology of Usher. You've heard of Bishop Usher and his chronology, where he believes that, I believe it was in October of 4004 B.C., at a certain date, at a certain time, I think it was 9:30 in the morning, that God created the heaven and the earth. That's absurd. I don't know how in the world he thought he could get that precise. But we do have an age range that's around 6,000 years old with regard to the genealogies. Now, are there some gaps? Possibly so. I would be willing to accept a date of 10,000 years as far as the beginning of the creation of the universe. But we cannot get to millions of years. And it's an interesting thing, depending upon the data that that you look at and the interpretation of that data, that figure of 6,000 to 10,000 years is one that comes up quite often in contrast with the evolutionists' view of you know the universe 13.8 and the Earth 4.5, and then even with regard to the life on the Earth, where we're talking about millions and millions of years. Okay, so those are the differences that that we have, and there is absolutely no way of accounting for or reconciling what we find as the inspired record that is contained in the genealogies and the evolutionary theories of an old earth. So we accept the concept of a young earth. It's ridiculed by most scientists. It's ridiculed even by some brethren. Phil Roberts is a man that we mentioned. Hugh Ross is another individual who ridiculed the concept of a young earth. And they have been invited to hold creation, evolution, evidences, lectures in various churches, at Florida College and other places. And they are advocates of an ancient earth that in fact, the Genesis account should not be taken literally. And they believe in the Big Bang Theory, and they believe that the universe is approximately 14 billion years old, as evolutionary scientists do. But I deny that that is the case. Now, if you'll notice on the handout, there are a total of five points that consist of some data that can be best interpreted from the biblical perspective of young Earth. And so we're going to look at these, and I'm just going to try to kind of quickly go over them. If you have any questions, I may not be able to answer them. We have some with science backgrounds in our number that may be a bit better in regard to it. And if I make any mistakes with regard to this, please excuse the fact that it is not an area of expertise. First of all, with regard to population, the population expansion over the years is something that is actually mathematically formulated. In other words, you can predict how fast population will grow, and you can extrapolate back in time as to how fast it has grown using mathematical equations. And I almost copied and pasted the equation, but it didn't mean anything to me, and I doubt it would for most of you, so I didn't put it. But you can go to, I think that particular article that I looked at was on the Apologetics Press website, and they had the actual accepted statistical equation with regard to how you come about it. So, we're going to take the possibility that early humans, maybe not Homo sapiens, because we talked about that a bit, but even 200,000 years, but the figure they used was a million years. So let's say the humanoids, various ancestors, have been on the Earth for the past million years. So what would be the population of the Earth using that particular? And we understand maybe there are some changes. Of course, they're the ones that advocate the doctrine of uniformitarianism, but there may be some changes, I wouldn't say extinction events, but there may be population drops because of disease or whatever. But still, looking at the idea, it's one followed by 5,000 zeros would be what statistics would show you as being the actual population of the Earth right now, and that's an absurd number. But the interesting thing about it is if you use the creationist figures, and of course that is not just with regard to Adam and Eve 6,000 years ago, but it has to do with the repopulation of the Earth following the Genesis flood. When this particular statistical study was given, it was back in 1973. And in 1973, that figure, according to statistic probability, would have been somewhere around 4.5 billion. You go back to 1973, you find that that's basically about the number of the population of the Earth. It is now 7 billion. And in that interim, it's kind of an exponential growth. And I'm sure someday in the future, it might level out, I suppose. But it's an exponential growth because the more you have, the more quickly the population grows. But in the last 25 years, it's gone from 4.5 billion to 7 billion. And that's the approximate, 7.2, I think, is the approximate population. So, again, the idea man existing for much longer than 4,000 years, then that would be something that statistically would indicate a much larger population on the Earth. Perhaps the maximum that the Earth would possibly sustain. It's kind of an interesting thing. You can go back to the early 1970s, and they said within a decade, the population of the Earth would exceed what is sustainable. That's one of the climatologists and the catastrophic predictions with regard to man's impact on the Earth. That hasn't actually come true. But scientists aren't always true or right on those things.
Have you ever figured that backwards? If you can figure exponential.
Yeah, it's you can extrapolate backwards as well as forwards.
And they should hit with a date.
Yeah.
With what we have and go.
Well, that's the point, is that if you were to take that statistical, it's in the thousands of years. It comes close to the time that we believe that the flood was upon the earth, rather than something that is explained in millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years. Ron, the agenda?
Yeah, I think, let me see if I can't correct a little bit. I read this last week. I think that's 500 zeros rather than 5,000. Which is still an enormous number of people, because there's no way it's getting on Earth. In fact, the whole universe would not hold that many people, not to 500 places.
Okay, that may have been something that I just, when I went from the website to the page.
I think it was just an error.
Okay. Well, that's a big error. Magnitude of 1,000 to Earth.
But still, the whole universe wouldn't hold that many people.
Yeah, okay. All right, so that's a... I'll have to go back and make sure of that, because I don't want to put it up on the internet incorrectly.
I'm thinking that that's what I read.
Okay.
And the fact is that the 1 million years of what the evolutionists say man has been here, and that number of people would be impossible to sustain. While the creationist, which is us, number would be easily sustained.
Good point. Yeah, that's one of the arguments that young Earth creationists utilize. Say one of the, in fact, it was stated as one of the strongest arguments that we have in that regard. Okay. All right. The second one is the decay of the Earth's magnetic field. This is again something that is measurable. It is something that is decaying in a consistent fashion. In other words, they've got another equation that they can do to determine how quickly the magnetic field is decaying around the Earth. What that comes from is the Earth's core, and there is a molten core, and the large electric current in that core is what creates the magnetic field surrounding the Earth. I forget how the numbers, but lots and lots of amps that make up this. But it has been decaying. And it is something that is measurable, and it is measurable, not only measurable, but it is also something that can they can generate a calculation with regard to it to determine, how much time will pass before it eventually gets to where it causes a problem, and you can also extrapolate backwards. And so in 1973, Thomas Barnes, who was the professor emeritus of physics at the University of Texas, he calculated the upper limit of the time span extrapolated backwards is 10,000 years with regard to the age of the Earth. And this is a quote from, well, not a quote, but a paraphrase of his contention. The last paragraph in that the last sentence in that paragraph, he contended that going back any further than that would cause the field to be at such huge values that the Earth could not sustain itself and would rupture and crack. So again, someone said, well, yeah, but... maybe this happened, maybe that happened, maybe it reset itself, maybe this happened. But again, this is just an assumption. You understand that. And what they have to do, if they're going to say, well, you know, this could have happened or that could have happened, then they're guessing as to what might have reset it or made it to where that wasn't the case, because you cannot extrapolate back 4.54 billion years and have the Earth's magnetic field where it is. But you do have a time frame of 10,000 years that is something that is doable within the construct of the young Earth view. Okay?
One other thing about this, it's interesting that in a little less than 2,000 more years, there will be no magnetic field, and that has to do with gravity. So there's an interesting concept for you, unless it does reset itself.
Yeah, I'm not, I don't know anything about that.
Me either.
Yeah, okay. So again, just these are some things that seem to point to the possibility that the Earth is much younger than what some view it to be. The third one is one that's interesting to me, because I can wrap my head around this a little bit, and that is the polystrate fossils. Now, again, understanding the doctrine of uniformitarianism, I probably should have put that at the front. Let's go over to the second page, the evolutionary assumptions regarding dating methods. The doctrine of uniformitarianism, I put a definition of that. And again, this is a general broad definition. But it's that the same natural laws and processes that operate in the universe now have always operated in the universe in the past and apply everywhere in the universe. So what happens with regard to sedimentation? When we talk about sedimentation, generally what happens is sedimentation happens gradually. Now sedimentation is the settling of particles, dirt, mud, silt, that kind of stuff, and those eventually turn into rocks. And so with regard to that, the idea is that you have over millions and millions of years this hardening of sediment. And when you hear sedimentary rock, that's what you're referring to, the various kinds of rocks. It's been a while since I took geology in that regard. There are different kinds of rocks, but one of them is sedimentary, and that's the silt and the mud and all settling and then hardening. Okay, so with regard to the doctrine of uniformitarianism, this is a process which happens over a long period of time, and yet there are numerous instances of fossils that actually cross over various eras in regard to the sedimentary strata. In other words, so you'll say, okay, this rock here is 20 million years old, this rock here is 10 million years old, and then you've got some fossil that is going from one part of the strata to the other, which would mean that fossil would have, I mean, it didn't make sense that it could have happened. If, for example, you have a tree trunk, let's take that as an example, because that's commonly what is the case with regard to these polystrate fossils. You'll have a tree trunk that is vertical, and as such, you've got the various sedimentary layers, which typically are basically because of gravity. They're one on top of each other, and then you've got this tree that's going through two or more of the layers. Well, how in the world could that be? Because if you had, you know, the sediment that's laid down and the tree dies, then the tree would rot if it was above the ground. It would rot long before there was a uniform settling of other sedimentary. But again, when you say that, okay, so well, maybe it didn't happen there, but the point is the doctrine of uniformitarianism that is used in establishing the geologic column. You've heard so much about the geologic column. You know, we know that fossils are X number of years old because they are in this particular part of the geologic column, this old rock. Well, how do you know how old the rock is? And you go through all that process, and you have the uniform laying down of sediment. And so the polystrate fossils tend, and they're very, they're prevalent. They're common to see those. And by the way, it's not only tree trunks. It's interesting that there are a couple of examples that I came across in my reading. One was of a big whale, I think it's 40 foot long, and another of just catfish, so a smaller, and other kinds of animals that actually are in two different different regions of sedimentary strata, which means millions of years having passed, which is not workable. It does accord with flood, which we'll talk about in just a little bit, but it's not something that is workable with regard to that concept. So these are anomalies. That's the whole point in this regard. These anomalies would tend to have you consider the concept of catastrophism of the flood rather than the doctrine of uniformitarianism. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing, polystrate fossils. I don't know exactly if we'll get through this in time or not, but I'll just keep on going unless someone hollers and says stop. The fourth one is hydrogen in the universe. This is an interesting one. Dr. Fred Hoyle, we mentioned him way back when, at the very beginning of our time together. He's an individual who late in his life came to the conclusion that there was intelligent design in the universe, though he cannot be said to be a creationist by any stretch of the imagination. He had this idea that the evidence seems to indicate there has to be design because of the complexities of the universe. And for the longest time, he was an English astronomer. In fact, he was such importance in the scientific community that he was made a knight. So he is Sir Fred Hoyle, in addition to being Dr. Fred Hoyle. Or maybe Sir Dr. Fred Hoyle, possibly, I don't know. But anyway, the hydrogen is an element. And as far as the means of producing hydrogen, there is no chemical reaction to produce large amounts of hydrogen that we know of in significant quantity. But what does happen continually in the universe is hydrogen breaks down to helium. It's a process. It's a one-way process that continues, and it's consistent. It's observable. And the idea is, since the universe to this date is made up of, I don't understand this, but again, I guess we're talking about the mass of the universe, and then we're talking about the stars and all these kinds of things. It's made up almost entirely of hydrogen. And so if you have an ancient universe, then there should be a depletion in those numbers. Now, that's a little bit problematic, and I understand that because of how much, but we're talking about the known amount of mass in the universe and the proportionate amount of that mass, which is hydrogen and or matter in the universe. That's something that led Dr. Hoyle to ask the question, how comes it then that the universe consists almost entirely of hydrogen? If matter was infinitely whole, this would be quite impossible. So we can see that the universe being what it is, the creation issue simply cannot be dodged. So again, this is just an argument with regard to this concept, because some have taken the position, of course, prior to the Big Bang Theory, of course, that matter was eternal. Matter's always been here, rather than God always being here. And I think that Hoyle was making that point in that quote. Okay, anybody? Am I confusing everyone? Try my best. Okay, last one, this is kind of interesting as well, is atmospheric helium. And again, if we were to go and look at what they were saying with regard to the old age of the universe, it would be just likewise as confusing as what we are with this, I think, or if I try to explain what they believe. But helium, how does helium get into our atmosphere? And they, again, we can measure how much helium is in our atmosphere. Well, it is called radiogenic helium, which means it is that which is released by radioactive isotopes, uranium and thorium, that are in the Earth's crust. So through the process of radioactive decay, helium is released from these two isotopes, and it's in the Earth's crust. It makes its way from the Earth's crust into the atmosphere. And so we know how fast that happens. And again, this is one of those things, if you measure how fast it happens, measure how much helium there is in the atmosphere, it corresponds to the age of the Earth of approximately 10,000 years. So that's the argument that is made with regard to that. Okay? Yes,
Tom? Very basically, this thing that I, of course, believe in the evolutions and all this stuff, when it's the 13.8 billion years and all this of the universe being old, what is there believed that happened and just a large blob of mass and then it exploded, making everything?
No, not a large blob of mass. It's hard for me to explain it because I don't really have the scientific expertise to do it. But I will say this: that the concept of the Big Bang, as you kind of alluded to, which is a singularity, an event which happened 13.82 billion years ago. But as far as how it happened and what preceded it, that's one of the things that Bill Nye said, that's a mystery. It was a magical thing. He actually used the phrase magical thing in that debate. So he makes fun of those who say faith and supernatural creation, but he talks about a magical thing we don't know. That's what we're looking, that's what we're trying to find out. So scientists can't explain it. They just say it happened. It's kind of like the same thing with regard to the concept of abiogenesis. This Fred Hoyle that we're talking about, he's a little bit of a maverick in regard to evolutionists. He thinks that the concept that life began on Earth through abiogenesis, and we talked about that before, that there wasn't life, then there was life, maybe through the deep sea vents and all. He said, that's ridiculous. It's absurd to think that that could happen. It's obvious that the only way that life could have come about is through, I forget now the word, panspermia or something like that, which basically is that there were viruses on comets. It basically, life in the universe, and it happened to hit our Earth, and that's the way it came about. So that's the view because of how ridiculous the concept of abiogenesis is. And of course, most evolutionists say, you know, we don't know how it happened, but once it did. And I want you, and I don't want to make fun, because then I'm doing exactly what they're doing in that regard. But I want you to understand the nebulous concepts behind. They get to a certain extent, certain place, and they can't go farther back. And so what they have to do is accept it by faith, where we're accepting that behind that is God. So we believe behind that is the supernatural. They believe that behind that is something else, and they can't explain it. And so it's all faith. It's just what you're going to believe in. Yes, sir?
I'm just going to correct something Kyle said, and it's just common perception. There was no literal explosion. There was no big bang. They use that term because, according to their theory, so much matter appeared so suddenly in the singularity you're talking about. I've seen that point with no dimension. And at that point, it started spreading so rapidly that it was as if it exploded. And all this is, my understanding is, it's based, you know, they didn't just backtrack. It's what they've done. They've taken current processes, what they perceive to be the current rate of expansion of the universe, for example, the redshift that came out in the early 1900s, all that. They backtrack all the way to this point using a lot of high-level math. Math is where most of this comes from. That's why they come back and they can say what happened in the first few milliseconds after the Big Bang. It's all mathematics. And that's how they get back to where it was. There's no literal explosion. They never claimed it there was.
They also make note of the fact that the Hubble Space Telescope and other things that what... And this is something that some of you are sufficiently familiar with understanding. But the farther away you look, you're looking basically into the past. If we accept the concept of uniformitarianism and the consistent speed of light through the years, is what you're seeing. So the farther away something is, the older it is in that sense. And so they've been able to go with the Hubble telescope and look at things that are really, really, really far away. And so they look at those kinds of things, and they're saying we're looking deep into the past. And some of the figures that they come up with in regard to this is also something that is a function of the Hubble Space Telescope. We might, or the observations with regard to physical light, we may need to talk about that some a little bit. I'll have to do a little research. There's a scientist who is an elder of the church in Houston that... It talks about the Big Bang theory and the concept of light as it reaches the Earth being those, and he has a scientific explanation for it that is a theory that's out there that's kind of interesting, but I didn't understand it, so I had to listen to it. And so this, okay, now what I want to do, and I thought that we'd get through this in one time. It's obvious I spent too much time in various areas, but I want to quote from Kyle Butt. He's one of the writers for the Apologetics Press, and there's three paragraphs. Starts at the bottom of the first page, and we'll talk a little bit about the dating methods, which is one of the primary reasons why I wanted to have this lesson. We'll talk about that in a couple of weeks when we come back in this class. But I want you to notice also, understand also, that when God created the Earth and the universe, there will be, as a result of the way in which the universe works, there's going to be an apparent age to the universe. He explains the reason why in this, and I've talked about this a little bit. It's not a dodge by any means, but it's a reality in the creation, in the 6 days of creation. It should not surprise us if science occasionally calculates older dates for the Earth due to a concept known as the doctrine of apparent age. The idea suggests that the things that God made during the creation week were formed complete and fully functional. For instance, how old were Adam and Eve 2 seconds after God created them? They were 2 seconds old. Yet if you were to look at them, examine them biologically, they walked, talked, looked like adults. They even had the ability to reproduce, which is one of the commands that God gave them in Genesis 1:28. If a tree were cut down in the Garden of Eden 1 day after the creation week, how many rings would it have had? Possibly hundreds, or tens, or tens. But it would have been only 5 days old. Trees and other plants were created on day 3 of the creation week. So the real age of the tree and the apparent age of the tree would have been quite different. Earth may appear older than 6,000 years. It doesn't mean it is older than 6,000 years. Now, this is an interesting, and I really like this paragraph. I think that there's some validity to this. Some people have suggested that if God made the earth appear older than it actually is, he has deceived us, because things aren't really as old as they look. And I want you to think about that, because that is a common argument that is raised. What you're saying is God's lying to you, because God has made things that look old when they really aren't. What he has done is make things fully developed, which would give them the appearance of age. But God is not lying to us. It couldn't be true, because God told us what he did. I love that. God told us what he did. He didn't leave us in the dark. He didn't try to trick us or test our faith by hiding from us important information we would need. Rather, he was very straightforward and honest with us. Considering the material found in the first 11 chapters of Genesis and elsewhere through the Bible, no one can justifiably accuse God of deceiving. If we ignore his word regarding what he said he did, it's not God's fault. It's our own. And Dennis has talked about this with regard to concept of faith and faith being required of us. We have been told, God has made clear what it is he has done, and his creative work is something that is attested to by the things that are made, so that they are without excuse. But individuals have determined to ignore what he said or to not believe what he said, and as such, then they are deceived by their own lack of faith. And I think that's a. I like the way he worded it. It's been his final paragraph there words it just as well as any that I've seen. So I'd encourage you to think about that. All right, we'll pick up with regard to the doctrine of uniformitarianism and the assumptions with regard to radiometric dating, such as carbon-14 dating and dating of miracles and rock miracles, and minerals and rocks, and some examples of why it may not be so in our discussion in a couple of weeks. Next week we have our meeting. Thank you very much for your kind attention tonight.